So, who has questions?
Do you want to start with a question?
Okay. I've just seen someone there.
Immediately.
Yeah.
You might know what to answer, I don't know, but where does the rhyming in the sentences running into different sentences, so a word finishing the last, complementing another word and then running into another, is it something that reminds me personally of something? Is there any particular place that comes from you?
What does it remind you of? I'm going to answer.
I'd rather not say.
Okay. Yeah, I think because I had, this sounds stupid, I had to go to theatre as a posh kid. My dad's an actor, and I had to see, you know, a lot of absurd theatre that I just didn't understand, but I was so fascinated by the sound of it. So the first thing, I find it really difficult to attach sound and meaning and to keep them both attached. I mean, thinking about it, I think it comes from that, it might not. So they stay attached and they make sense, and then suddenly the sound sort of carries on and I stay with the sound rather than with the meaning, and it takes me to something else, and then that meaning drops into it, and so these shifts happen. Does that make sense? But yeah, I think it was because I was exposed to so much really rhythmatized sound that I had to make my own, because I understood partially and tuned in and out. I think now I know that Elfriede Jelinek, who's a brilliant German playwright and author, she uses this technique a lot, but in German.
So Emma's got a question.
Thank you. I thought it was really terrific, and I'm very glad I changed my schedule so I could come. I'm interested in the relationship between the sculptures, objects, environments, and the texts. And the work reminded me, in a kind of oblique way, of Rana. I saw Rana Hamaday do one of her Alien Encounters performances last year, and she talked about the work that was in galleries that the curators called installations. She said they are sets. They're sets. So she was saying she very much didn't want them to be seen as sculptural or as installation. But then that was a trade-off, I guess, for having them in galleries. And I wondered if you could talk to us a little bit more about whether there is any kind of hierarchy between the things you make, the things you write, and the things you perform.
I don't think there's a hierarchy. They shift at times. I used to think there was always the prop. So I think of them as props, not as installations. Not as sets either, because the thing with the set is that the action is what counts, and the props are given very little attention, even though they actually, I mean, props are used to define a character, you know, an actor who's trying to find his or her character uses a prop to sort of define themselves, right? They also propel narrative further. They're really important, but they're hardly ever seen, or, you know, they're these, if you look at them close, they're really shabby objects, usually. So I think of them as props. They're propped up, they're propositions, and they have infinite properties, which I try and sort of pick out with the text and see, try and not. I don't want to define them. I have a lot of I mean, I don't make them, I find things and put them together, so none of this is mine, I just sort of suggest something. Also, they keep elements from one sculpture will then be in another sculpture again, and elements from it.
But I feel I have to be very careful to undermine the objects and define them as something, because I found them, I don't know where they come from. If I do know, then possibly parts of their history will come into the text, but they're their own thing, and I just...
So can the props ever disagree or shift?
They shift a lot. They shift from sculpture to sculpture, and some... It's really annoying, actually. I just had this situation because I don't sell very easily for obvious reasons. And now I had an exhibition in Vienna where people actually wanted to buy, and I had to say, well, these props can't be sold because this element and this prop is part of three other things. So I would be giving you... I would be deleting three other... texts, props, yeah.
So does that mean your work is an event then? You know, if they're not items to be sold and you don't want to move the props.
Yeah, I think so.
An event.
Yeah, probably. Definitely, I think of them as suggestions. So that would be time based. None of them are stable. I don't want them to be stable.
Other questions? Dave? Yeah, go ahead. There's one in the front row. Dave, and then there's Holly afterwards. So Sharon at the back. Holly's got her hand up. So Dave first.
Great. I was wondering how you found yourself in the contemporary art world or the gallery world. It feels like there's a lot of elements that could exist within kind of experiential theatre, especially this idea of props and formative work, and I wondered if firstly how that kind of came about, but whether you feel like this, for example, the performance or the excerpts that you showed us feels like that's the most comfortable home for it now, and why that is.
I think it's not theatre because it's my family's in theatre and I wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. So I went to study linguistics first, which is actually extremely boring. It's such an interesting field, but the place I studied it at was dreadfully boring. And then photography, which is a very silent, or I thought is like the most silent creative form I could find to be as far away from theatre as possible. But then it sort of slowly, the performance slowly came in. I think it was my BA degree show where I had to explain to my teachers and the I'm going to say jury, the assessors, what it was, and I spent ages talking about these works that were abstract. I couldn't see anything on them really, and they couldn't. I mean, what I was saying and what they were seeing didn't make sense together. But then one of the students told me, actually, the way you talk about your work is a lot more interesting than your work, which at the time was really brutal to hear. But then. Yeah, it sort of stuck with me, and I guess the talking about the work became the thing. And I think the gallery context is good in that I performed this in a theatre this summer, and the audience is really, I mean, a gallery audience is used to stark lighting, moving about, and really sort of casually engaging. You can chat to them. And you can look at them straight, there's no lights in your face, and you don't have to stay in the role or anything. And I think this casualness I really like, because you can shift much more easily.
Holly?
Hi, thank you firstly for showing us your work. But I just wanted to ask, I know you were saying about the props are sort of shifted amongst the displays and how it is, and you were saying with this, obviously you had multiple episodes. Did you find that the props would shift in between then, or was it very much the same setting for each episode?
Conceptually, I wanted to shift the props. I thought that would be a really nice thing. But in the end, I realised that actually they sort of... I mean, it took 6 weeks to... I lived in there for... work on it for 6 weeks, but I lived there for 6 weeks. And they slowly found their constellations. And I did tweak things constantly, and one sculpture completely disappeared and another one changed quite drastically, actually, from the beginning to the end. But probably from episode to episode, you wouldn't have noticed it. But overall, it stayed pretty much the same, because I needed the stability for the improvisation as well, I think, to know what is where. And yeah.
Thank you.
I've got a question for a friend. You know, your husband in the work. Yeah. So, is he a performer or artist, or you know, what does he do, and how do you manipulate him into your performances?
Is he a prop?
Who
is he a prop?
Who do you think? No.
He's.
Let me just take some notes.
He's a. He's just a really good person. He's a lecturer. He doesn't. No, he's not an artist. But he helps me with everything, and he really enjoys it. He doesn't get a lot of sense or. He doesn't get a lot of reward from just teaching, and so he really enjoys going on road trips. He says he does, I hope he does, going on road trips with me and helping me and handing me things and staying overnight with me in the studio. So this role of him being my assistant is actually pretty accurate,
yeah.
Just that I don't order him about quite as much, but I kind of...
Yeah, I'll let my friend know that he enjoys it and... Yeah,
but you know what's interesting? You know, I mean, usually you have this, you know, the doctor and the
praxis guild.
Usually it's the woman assistant, okay, maybe
yeah.
Think of a magician show
exactly.
Or something. And the magician presents and says, can you just pass me this? It's never a problem, right? But I was never rude to Peter. I never told him off. I just told him what to get me because it was important that I had the objects there so I could continue with the show. So many people commented on how badly I treated him. It's like, I didn't. I said thank you. It's just that he was a man bringing me things. Like, oh my god, your husband does everything for you. Like, no, he played the assistants. It was striking. Just really, how many people commented on that? Said I would never do that.
Pete's got a question here.
Hi. I was just wondering about the relationship you have with project spaces and curators, especially when you're doing a lot of improvised work and like this sense of like boundaries as well when you're living in the gallery for 2 weeks. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
It's different every time. My housemate told me I should probably come up with a PDF that explains how I work, because I think it's very disconcerting for curators or gallerists, because I have no, you know, I can never say my work is about this and this. I'm going to do a project on the theme of this. So they find it very difficult to write a blurb about it or to, you know, they want to know what I'm going to put in there. And generally I arrive with a carload or vanload full of stuff that has already been in some configurations. But it's like a collection of things that I think go together, and I have nuggets of texts for them or ideas. And then I establish it in the space, and I need, from morning 8 o'clock until 2 a.m, I will be working, and I won't be able to enjoy dinners or meet people or anything, so it's really intense. Which, yeah, I realize more and more, you really have to warn people. Some love it and want to be part of it, and others, it's difficult.
There's a question here. Oh, wait, the microphone. Yeah, I've been here.
Yeah, basically, just at the beginning, before you sort of gave any context to your work, I found it quite interesting listening to you speak, and I was sort of wondering the way you come about writing these texts, because to me, it sort of struck me sort of like as an outpouring or like a stream of consciousness. It was like you know, like a window into someone's mind or something, but I just wondered if maybe I was wrong and you did actually put some editing process sort of into it.
So the first gesture is, first act, whatever, is automatic writing. Yeah, I have, with the props, I have a long list of things that they remind me of, or a mind map that I have, and I have nuggets of maybe quotes that I think are important that I have to somehow weave into it. But then I just go for it. And then there's loads and loads of editing afterwards. Like with this text that I read, I left out some chunks, but this, these themes that keep coming back in different disguises. So I want to put riddles in, and you can't do that if you just, if you're really good at it, you probably can control if you're left alone for hours to write, you probably can summon the concentration to do that. It's the editing process actually that takes longest and is most fun as well, because you can put all these riddles in and all these relations.
Thank you.
Any other question?
I have a question. I want to know a little bit more about the overt politics of the work, the politics that are clearly stated but woven through that you might miss if you didn't have a political bone in your body, but the slightest hint of that political leaning would show them to be intensely political works in my reading of them.
Yeah.
If you could say a little bit more about that.
And
that they're historically located or in the present of politics.
Yeah. I think because it's I don't plan a text. I write it with all the anger and fury that I have at that point. And so first, if it's a prop sculpture, I sit in front of it and just think of anything that it reminds me of. And if I'm preoccupied with a certain theme, then almost anything will somehow bring it back to that. And I'm constantly torn between wanting to say something and like screaming it out in a very blunt way, and thinking, well, I'm not, who am I to say anything? Who am I to tell anyone what's right or wrong? So I have to construct these conversations where maybe one voice is very blunt and the other voice sort of tries to undo it, and then you can read it as political, but you don't feel like you have to agree with me from the beginning because there's more than one voice or something. It's often very banal as well.
So not all your metaphors are kind of equal, are they? It's like some kind of just drop. They're mentioned and then they drop and then some reoccur. Is that something that you're consciously working with, or what's the role of metaphor and motif? Building on what Sharon was saying.
I think I like to make people, or the audience, or even myself, the reader, whoever, think that they're onto something and they can now decipher it and come up with the solution to the riddle. But the dropping of things, or also the introducing of metaphors that actually aren't metaphors, they mean nothing. They just sound good. Means that you really have to watch every step, and you have to, or you read them, which is great as well. I had in this Vienna show, there was a piece with a horse called, what's it called? Air is up in the air, no. the move that the horses in the Spanish riding school have to do.
It's not one of my references.
Anyway, no, it doesn't matter. And there was blue velvet, and I sang a bit of the Queen of the Night. And he heard, because of the he saw Lloyd's TSB and read it as read it that way. I don't know exactly what how he connected Lloyd's TSB with what I was saying. I think just it's important that things are allowed to drop, and also when you write, it's important to allow everything out. Some things you think, I'll leave that lying here, maybe I'll find a way to attach to it and create some content, or not.
Any more? Brian's got one. Brian's got a question.
Thank you. Just on that, following on that subject of metaphor and someone making an association from the material and then taking it into an area that maybe you don't quite get or understand, is that, it's obviously a risk with something which is so kind of metaphorically and symbolically rich, and that people just spin out in different ways. How do you, is that a problem? How do you deal with it? Do you try and shut down some of that deliberately?
No, the opposite. This is actually what I want to happen. So all the readings are just suggestions, and because the readings are never finite and there's so many even contradicting or overlaying readings, you know, I would hope that people phase out and don't listen to me anymore and continue with their own. This is the problem that I always have with looking at art. And what does it mean? What does it represent? What doesn't represent any one thing? How sad would that be if it represented one thing? So if you can, I think it's not arbitrary. I think I try and sort of make these sado props, prop assemblages in a way that, you know, there's enough different material from different contexts with different texture and different lifelines and everything, that you would have associations, that they would sort of start conversing amongst themselves, and you can enter that conversation between all the elements of the prop. And I'm just doing an exemplary reading of it, and then they're free to be read. And I think even I've heard from friends, I don't want to say, I've heard from loads of people who know my work and not my work, I've heard from friends that with my voice in their head, they can look at props and sort of, it helps them to get into them. So the performance is sometimes really just a way to say, why don't you do this? Something like this, or you could do it like this. Goodbye.
I don't think we have any time for any more questions, but I thought I'd end just by saying that when you were talking, I think your voice was a really welcome guest in my head.
That's nice.
And when you stopped talking, I sort of almost missed it. Oh. But I tell you, you know, some shows you're in and there's voice in the work, and you just think, oh, I've got to get out now. I've got someone else's voice in my head too long. I've got to get out.
Yeah.
But your voice was a really welcome guest.
That's very nice to hear.
Okay, so thank you, Sophie.
Thank you very much.